Hello and welcome to another episode of The Recommended Dose, the podcast promoting a more questioning approach to healthcare, produced by Cochrane Australia and co-published by the BMJ. Today, one of Australia's and the world's leading public health researchers joins me, Ray Moynihan, to shine a light on the social and economic determinants of health. Professor Fran Boehm is a Matthew Flinders Distinguished Professor of Public Health and the Director of the Southgate Institute of Health, Society and Equity at Flinders University in South Australia. I started off by asking her to briefly explain what the social determinants of health are and why they're so important.
Yeah, well, at the most basic level, it's about what happens in your everyday life. So I think most people will know whether or not you've got a job. That makes a big difference to both your physical and mental health. Whether you've got good housing, you know, if you're in insecure housing, that's likely to affect your health in all sorts of ways. If you're in unsuitable housing, if it's damp in a cold country, or if you don't have any cooling in a very hot country. It's also about the kind of environments we live in. So the way our cities are planned is really important. Are they friendly for pedestrians? Are they easy to move around? Do they enable us to connect with other people? So it's all those things about everyday living, but it's also about I always use this analogy of an iceberg. It's like what's below those conditions, and that's about how power and resources are distributed. So who has most money in a country? Who has the wealth? You know, who's able to make decisions? Who can make decisions in their interests? So it's both those levels, the sort of everyday living conditions and those issues of power and resources.
We'll get to inequality soon, but first, how strong is the evidence, the scientific evidence, to support those links between those social determinants you're talking about and people's actual health?
Yeah, well, the links have been recognised for a long time. I mean, you go back to the 19th century and famous sort of public health doctors like Virchow were producing reports on how social determinants affect our health. So, you know, that there's a long history of evidence. And, of course, the Commission on the Social Determinants of Health that was set up by the WHO also had a strong evidence base to it, had 9 knowledge networks that compiled all the evidence. And the evidence comes in various forms. So we can show that for individuals, so if you take a social determinant like how much early childhood education do you get, how much good development when you're a child, we know that that has a lifelong effect. And we can show that in individuals. So for instance, a study has shown that if you look at kids from different economic classes, from working class and middle classes, they can have the same educational attainment at 5, but if you then look again at 12, you find that it's divided. So it's nothing intrinsic to the children, it's the experiences that they've had. But we can also show evidence across a society. So if we compare the country that's longest lived in the world, Japan, with that's the least long lived, somewhere like Sierra Leone, where life expectancy is about 30 years less than Japan, we're not saying, well, that difference is because those people behave differently. That difference is because they have very different social and economic environments. So in Japan, most people have a suitable house. Most people traditionally have had a job. Most people are able to live in reasonably supportive environments and have access to good and healthy food. Whereas in Sierra Leone, there's major problems of water and sanitation, of housing, of what kind of employment there is, and generally a much poorer community. And that shows up in health. And the other thing to note, I think the really interesting information is that the other evidence is that health depends not so much on your absolute wealth, but really on its distribution and what you do with it. And there I always like to compare a country like Costa Rica with the US. Now, in terms of life expectancy, Costa Rica does slightly better than the US. People there live about 6 months longer than in the US on average. Infant mortality rates a little bit higher in Costa Rica, 8.5 compared with 5.6 for the US. But when we look at how much income there is per capita in the country, Costa Rica only has a little over $10,000 and the US has over $50,000. So somehow on a much lower wealth, they're producing better health than the US. And they also spend a lot less on health expenditure. In the US, they're spending something like over $9,000 and in Costa Rica, only $1,300 per capita. And they're kind of adjusted rates. rates. So you can see that the evidence is, when we look at whole populations, you can see the impact of social determinants really strongly.
How important, how serious is early childhood education as a determinant of health, and how's Australia handle that?
Yeah, well, I mean, early childhood education and care has a huge impact on health. I mean, it affects language, numerical skills, and the impact's lifelong. You know, it affects people's job prospects, their earning potential, and, you know, it contributes to breaking down intergenerational poverty cycles. So that kind of early year mental stimulation is absolutely vital. And I think a US presidential report calculated that for every dollar invested in early learning initiatives, $8 were returned. So it's a great investment for governments. But the evidence also suggests that it has to be high quality. And there was an author, Friendly, who defined what a high quality early childhood education and care programs should look like. And the first one of those, in response to your question, Ray, was that they have to employ staff who are well educated for their work and have decent working conditions and wages. And I think in Australia, childcare workers really are not paid very well. So we don't tick that box. They also said we need to organise children into groups of manageable size with adequate numbers of adults, and we probably do that. And then, you know, it also says that they have to be sort of challenging, non-didactic, play-based, creative, enjoyable activities, and they have to be in very well-designed physical environments. So, and I think the issue in Australia is for people getting access to those kind of environments for their children at a cost they can afford. And I think, you know, in some countries, particularly in Scandinavia, that kind of early childhood development is free for parents. It's taken for granted. You know, when your child reaches three, they have access to that childcare or younger if the parents wish, and there is no cost. So there's some really important questions there, I think, about how much we are investing in early childhood and whether it's a, you know, in Finland, for instance, which I know quite well because I have a relative who lives there, all the childcare is publicly provided. It's not privatised. And in Australia, we've gone down the route of privatised childcare, which means much more regulation needed, much harder to ensure quality than if you have a sort of uniform public system. And of course, if you have a uniform public system, then it's the same for all citizens of the country, not just for those who can afford to buy their way into a more privatised service.
It's interesting, isn't it? Whenever you think about the social determinants of health, you start to think about health differently. I mean, a lot of the popular imagination about health and medicine focuses on doctors, on drugs, on hospitals, on surgery. But whenever you talk about the social determinants, you start to see that those things have a role, but there's all these other things going on, i.e. the quality of childcare, that can directly or slowly or more profoundly impact on the healthy nature of our lives.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Whichever, you know, kind of social determinant you look at, when you think it through, you can see that it just has such a powerful impact on our health. You know, it just, and it's through the entire life course. It's going to just affect people's school success, their, how well they can participate in jobs, you know, how well they can probably form relationships. So, you know, it has implications for family life, community life. And I think for social mobility, having a really good access to that kind of early childhood education is fantastic. You know, a lot of working class kids would benefit incredibly from having access to that kind of stimulation, the educational opportunities and the opportunities for play that they may not have at home. So it would also contribute to reducing those inequities we've been talking about.
Given what you know about what determines people's health, how frustrated do you get watching the media, listening and reading the media, where so much of the coverage is focused on all the clinical innovations and clinical interventions?
Yes, I must admit that when I turn on the television and you hear of another cure for another disease that's in its really early development stage and, you know, may never actually result in that, it's very frustrating. And, you know, we very rarely see a story on kind of how the social determinants of health might affect you. You know, if we open a new childcare centre, this is going to have an amazing impact on those children through their life. And we know that most health services really happen when you're sick towards the end of your life. And yes, they're important and we all want access to those, but they're not really promoting health. They're helping us deal with sickness. But when we talk about promoting health and well-being, it's those other broader things like education, jobs, housing, you know, whether you've got access to money or not, that are making the really big difference to your health.
As you know, this podcast is produced by Cochrane Australia, and indeed the Cochrane Network has a lot of systematic reviews of the sort of evidence you're talking about, so it's there for everyone to see, really. You know, if we took social determinants more seriously at a governmental level, at a policy level, how would the practice of medicine change? I mean, we spend so much on the acute care, on drugs, on hospitals, on GPs, on family doctors. If we took this evidence that you're talking about more seriously, how would that healthcare system change?
Yeah. Well, I think there'd be two changes. One is, if we really took the evidence seriously, then one would question, if we're saying that the goal of a society is to promote health and well-being, then we would question how much resources we spend on the health sector. Because the sort of best evidence and some Canadian evidence suggests that maybe healthcare contributes to around 20 to 25% of producing population health, whereas social determinants of health are sort of over 50%, the rest being perhaps some contribution from behaviours and people's sort of genetic factors. So that's the first thing. We'd say, well, hang on, we want to make people healthier. We actually isn't the health sector that's primarily going to do it. It's all the other sectors in government. And then I think within the health sector, there'd be sort of two ways that we'd look at it. One, within the health sector, there has to be strong leadership to adopt a sort of social determinants of health response. And I think most importantly, that would be a health sector that's based on comprehensive primary health care. In other words, community-based health care that's very accessible, that as well as treating people's illnesses and indeed referring them on, but also puts an emphasis on keeping people well and working with other services to say, how can we make our local community as healthy as possible? So that could be working with local government as the World Health Organization advocates through its Healthy Cities program. But it primarily says, let's have a system based on primary health care. Whereas increasingly, we seem to be getting a system based on specialist care, which, and I think the further you go away from primary health care, the less able the health system is to take into account the impact of the social determinants of health. I think a health system that was thinking about the social determinants of health would also be looking at issues of access, because that in itself is a social determinant. Who has good access to healthcare, who doesn't? So, you know, in Australia, Aboriginal people have a life expectancy some 10, 11 years less than other Australians. And some of that is attributable to the fact that when they use health services, they very often come across racist responses or the services aren't culturally appropriate. And there's lots of ways in which the health system can become more culturally appropriate, can employ Aboriginal liaison officers, it can ensure that the staff are aware of when they're being racist, because very often staff aren't. So there's a whole lot of training you can do, for instance, there. Same with people whose first language isn't English. You could make sure that the service is accessible to them by using interpreters and so on. So there's lots of ways within the health system that can happen, which I would call leadership for health.
I want to just mention your latest book. It's called Governing for Health.
Yes.
And so let's talk a little bit about the role of government here. You tweeted very enthusiastically about the latest budget from the New Zealand government.
Yes.
You said that if only we could have a budget like this, a good and healthy life for all is so much more than a strong economy. New Zealand is governing for health. For those who haven't heard about that New Zealand budget, what was so good about it?
Well, what was good about it was that instead of putting fiscal matters first, the government made the decision to put health and well-being first. So it was called a well-being budget. So they, for instance, have making large government investment in early childhood education. And that's such a good investment for the future because you're preventing problems. If you can give kids a good start in life, you're preventing lots of problems that will, down the track, be costing governments money, such as the prison system, people more likely, if they have a dicey start to life, more likely to end up addicted to a whole range of substances, more likely to be in the health system. So there's a whole lots of ways in which that is a sound investment. I think the New Zealand government's also investing heavily in local mental health services, which are to support people locally. That, again, in the long term, will be really good for society. So they're making decisions about what will be good for health and well-being, rather than just saying, well, if we get the economy right, then the rest will follow. And one of the things I say in governing for health is that we can have a healthy fiscal sector. And that means that we have to put social health and equity concerns before private profits. And, you know, we have to recognise that if we want a healthy fiscal sector, it probably involves higher taxation, not lower taxation. And, of course, progressive taxation, so that richer people pay more than low-income people. It could include taxes on wealth and inheritance, which are a way of redistributing income and wealth. Because at the moment in Australia, we're becoming a much less equal society. And that in itself appears to have an impact across the whole population and makes all of us, whether we're wealthy or not wealthy, less healthy.
You wrote in the British Medical Journal, the BMJ, last year that government protection of transnational corporations is the greatest threat to health. Can you explain what that means?
I guess one of the things that the work we've been doing at Flinders University is looking at the health impact of corporations. And we've developed a corporate health impact assessment, which takes a whole look at a corporation and says, well, how healthy is its activities? So In doing that, we obviously look at the products that are produced by the corporation, and they can be healthy or unhealthy, but we also look at their kind of lobbying activities. So what are they lobbying government about and how do they do that? How much tax do they pay in the countries where they're operating, or are they engaging in tax avoidance? What is their occupational health and safety record like? What about their environmental cleanup record if it's an extractive industry? What about their marketing, particularly for the food industry? And what we're finding is that there's much more scope for there to be more government regulation. Just to give one example, we were comparing the operations of Rio Tinto between South Africa and Australia, much the same kind of mining operation. The injury, the rate of accidents in South Africa was much higher than in Australia. And we concluded that's because the regulations around mine occupational health and safety are much tighter in Australia than they are in South Africa. That's just to give one example. And I think, you know, many of the listeners will know that there are big debates about, well, should we tax products such as high sugar drinks and foods, you know, and how much would that reduce the currently increasing obesity epidemic? So there's lots of ways in which corporations are able to manipulate government so that they take decisions which favour the corporations. And there are lots of ways in which governments would have space to be able to regulate the corporations. So I increasingly, you know, if you think of the 100 biggest economies in the world, about 70 of those are now corporations, not countries. Only 30 are countries. So the power and control of corporations is increasing immensely.
We'll come back in a minute to how one can address that power, if at all. But first, let's talk a little about Australia. You've observed the social determinants of health in Australia, and you've written that the richer the area you live in, the longer you can expect to live. I mean, Australians like to think of themselves and project themselves on the world stage as the land of the fair go. Does the evidence suggest otherwise?
The evidence does suggest otherwise. I mean, we know that economic inequality is increasing in Australia, but some data produced by John Glover and colleagues at the Public Health Information and Development Unit, which is the University of Torrens, they've mapped the degree of inequality in health status since the late 80s through to, I think it was 2017, their latest data, and it's getting worse. The state I live in, South Australia, for instance, has gone from being the second most equal state to we're now the second least equal state. And every state and territory, in terms of health equity judged by socioeconomic status, has become less healthy in the last three decades. And I think that's a real cause for concern.
You mentioned before the most glaring inequity in Australia, and that's that 10 years or so life gap between Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander Australians and others. Can you give listeners who aren't familiar with this extensive inequality in Australia a sense of the different health status of Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians?
Yeah, I mean, there is a 10-year gap, but it's not only a gap in terms of when you die, it's also a gap in how healthy you are when you live. And many Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australians live with a higher disease burden than non-Indigenous Australians. I mean, I think, you know, just the existence of rheumatic heart disease that has been, for instance, eradicated in the rest of the Australian population, and it's still a major problem in the Northern Territory for Aboriginal people, is just some indication that the health issues are very different and that they're reflecting social conditions very strongly. And of course, you know, for Aboriginal people in Australia, they're living in a land that was their land, that was then colonised, and then they were subjected to 200 plus years of colonised policies, some of which included, you know, rhetoric such as smoothing the pillow of the dying race. So it's not surprising that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people experience worse health. When you think about all the evidence on the impact of racism on health, and you're living in a society that is heavily colonised, then that's inevitably going to result in poor health outcomes for people. And I think it's a big challenge for Australia, not just to tackle, you know, what I'd call the tip of the iceberg, say looking at smoking behaviour or looking at eating behaviour, but to say, well, you know, how do we make this society much more respectful of its first peoples? How do we empower people to take power so that they can live lives that they feel are worth living, basically? And one of the big breakthroughs, I think, in the last couple of years was the agreement of many Aboriginal people to the Uluru Statement from the Heart that was signed at Uluru and actually almost gave an olive branch to the rest of Australia and said, look, we really want to come to some agreement with the people who have settled on this land. But so far, the olive branch has been rejected by government, which I think is a real shame, because I think that kind of acceptance that, yes, there has been a terrible history, but we are prepared to move on in partnership would make a big difference to the health of our First Nations in Australia.
I just read the Uluru Statement from the Heart on the weekend, just happened to see it and read it. Mm. It's a short statement, and it's something that I'd really recommend to anyone, Australian or otherwise. It's a beautiful piece of writing. There's been a lot of work for a long time, but particularly of late, trying to close that gap. I mean, some of the other statistics you've written about, Indigenous people 5 times more likely to have end-stage kidney disease. There's many statistics like that, but there has been work trying to close that gap. Is that work making inroads into this very bleak picture?
It's made a little inroad, I think, you know, to infant mortality rates, but it's really not making as much progress as people would have hoped when the Close the Gap strategy was launched. The good thing is that there is bipartisan support for it, and there is a report from the Prime Minister to Parliament which holds accountable for the difference. But I think in lots of ways, it's not, you know, it goes some way to tackling some social determinants of health, such as employment, but I don't think it's going to those underpinning ones. And, you know, just one statistic, that Aboriginal women are 21 more times likely to be imprisoned than non-Aboriginal women. And very often that's for non-payment of fines or some minor offence. But you can imagine the impact it has on Aboriginal children, on the women themselves, you know, splitting up families. And when it's at that kind of level of imprisonment, then I think we really have to ask ourselves, how have we created a system that means that Aboriginal people are so much more likely to be incarcerated. Something like 97% of the children in the Northern Territory who are in juvenile detention are Aboriginal, even though there are only about a third of the population. So, you know, there's some very real issues that we have to face as a nation, I think, and really look at a much more root and branch tackling of the issue of this closing the gap than just saying, well, it's about employment or it's about education. Yes, it is about those things, but it's also about the systemic racism, the systemic history of colonialism that is very evident in Australia today.
Moving back out from Australia to a more global context, you mentioned before your work on that big WHO Social Determinants of Health, that Commission on Social Determinants of Health, quite a famous landmark report more than 10 years ago now. But can you tell us a little bit about whether that commission has had an impact and what sort of impact it's had?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think as a commission, I think we did have an impact, and I think the report is widely quoted and it's used and the evidence in there is used. But unfortunately, over that period, the gains have been slight. I mean, there have been subsequent reports from Europe, from the UK, most recently the World Health Organization in America's produced a report. And actually in Latin America, some of those trends of inequality have been reversed in the last two decades. It's a little bit more hopeful there perhaps than in the rest of the world. But generally, the pattern is for economic inequities to increase, and then what follows with that is that health inequities increase. And as I've already said, in Australia, that is really happening at quite a pace. While overall health has got better in the last three decades, the extent of inequity, it hasn't been so equally shared. So if you're better off in Australia, you've done better from the health gain than other Australians.
Do we need a national commission? That was a global commission. Does every country need its own commission on the national determinants of health?
I think it would be excellent. I mean, if we could. But I think, you know, that it's got to be backed by a real political will to want to reduce inequities. I mean, another commission that just gives another report without a strong commitment to action, I don't think would be useful. So it's about that. We have a National Health and Medical Research Council, Centre for Research Excellence, which is looking at health equity. And one of the things, as we look at policies and see how they impede or advance health equity, we keep coming up with this concept of political will for equity, and it's quite elusive. But you can see in countries where there is a commitment to equity, then the kind of policies like we've already talked about in New Zealand will, I'm sure, make a difference to both the overall health of the population, but also how equally it is shared. But without that political will, we could have as many commissions and reports as we like, but unless things get implemented, then, you know, we're not going to make much progress in that area.
You've worked a lot with the World Health Organization, and I think one of your recent tweets was celebrating a change there where they established a healthier population division. And I think you said it was really music to my ears.
I did.
Why so?
Well, one of the story of the commission was that the Director General, Dr. Lee, that established the commission, he very unfortunately died very suddenly of a stroke halfway through the commission. And of course, he had a strong commitment to that work. And the next Director General really finished the Commission's work, but really didn't do a strong follow-up within WHO. She had other priorities. And it's very good with the new Director General, Dr. Tedros, that he has asked Sir Michael Marmot, who chaired the Commission on the Social Determinants of Health, to be a special advisor to WHO on social determinants. And within a couple of months at the time of the World Health Assembly, he has announced this Healthier Populations Division, which will focus on those underlying determinants and will have a special section which is looking at social determinants of health that's going to have more dedicated resources than has been the case in the last few years. So maybe that will mean the work of the Commission will again have a much stronger focus in WHO. And I think we're hopeful. I've spoken to Sir Michael, and I think he's hopeful that this is going to be a sort of renaissance of the ideas within the organisation. And as the flagship for global health, I think that that's got to be good news. And, you know, and hopefully they can again promote even more than they have been projects such as the Healthy Cities Movement, which works with local government, the Health in All Policies Movement, which works with both regional governments and national governments to put across this idea that health is not just the responsibility of the health sector, but it's something every sector of government needs to think about.
Looking back over the incredible work you've done and are doing still, it's an amazing output. Is it easy or is it hard to find that music for your ears? How often do you hear that music?
Yes, it's not that often. And I must say that, well, I guess what inspires me is the work I do with the People's Health Movement, because there I'm working with friends and comrades from around the world, and many of whom are working in extraordinarily difficult situations, such as Palestine, such as the Congo in West Africa. And you really realise then that the struggles that we are facing in countries that are wealthy are nothing like those of those colleagues. They're much, much tougher battles. And when I look at the work that they're doing, it is inspiring. So I'm very much inspired by those comrades. And I think that really enables me to keep going, because sometimes you do think, gosh, we're actually going backwards in Australia. And people say, oh, well, your research should make an impact. And you think, well, the impact it's made is negative rather than positive. But I think it's that old activist slogan, the situation is impossible, so we must take the next step. I have to keep reminding myself of that.
So you still remain convinced that positive change to address these big determinants, economic, environmental, social, that it is possible to address those to improve health?
Yeah, I think it is. And what I haven't mentioned, and probably importantly, is that the other thing I always talk about is a nutcracker effect. And yes, you need the political will and the top-down support, but you also need a people's movement. And, you know, if I look around the world, I think there are more and more movements that are saying, we actually want to change the way society is organised so that it is better for our children, so it is healthier, so that we do have a planet that will support human life. And I think, you know, if you look at the New Zealand example, a lot of people in Australia are saying, I wish we had a Prime Minister like Jacinda Ardern. Wouldn't it be wonderful? Who's positive, who puts forward a vision, who has some very positive visions for what the future of society could be like and what a difference that would make to people. So, I that can make me optimistic. Though, you know, sometimes I do think, gosh, this is just too hard and things aren't changing as I'd like them to.
And that Prime Minister of New Zealand's a DJ as well, so I guess we'd get a bit more music to our ears.
Yes, probably. Yes.
Professor Franbone, thank you so much for coming on The Recommended Dose.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Ray.
You've been listening to The Recommended Dose with me, Ray Moynihan. The show's produced by Cochrane Australia and is co-published by the BMJ. Thanks to producer Shauna Hurley and to our sound editor Jan Mutz and to Paul Stoll from the media studio at Flinders University. And thank you for listening.